And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. As we tape this, we're still adjusting to a post-Beyoncé halftime show world, and we'll check in a little about the Super Bowl, the spectacle, and any actual genius we can dig up. Speaking of annual milestones, by the time you hear this, we'll be very close to the approach of Valentine's Day. Now, we're not really Valentine's Day people, any of us, but we thought we'd give a little thought to romance in pop culture, and especially to what we consider truly romantic as opposed to fake romantic. And as always, we'll wrap up with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and theater and such like for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
So it is the day after the Super Bowl.
It is.
It is the day after, as longtime listeners know, Stephen's party Chicken Bowl.
Yes.
Which was won this year by a young man who put on a valiant display, I'm sure, of...
Yes, and at the end, unfortunately, I can't remember his last name. Mm-hmm. It's a dude named Brian.
It is
some
a dude
guy named
Brian.
And you know, when you throw these parties long enough, there are a lot of people of indeterminate origin.
Right, exactly.
But this guy Brian, not only did he win the night, he won the coveted Chicken Bowl Championship tiara.
Wonderful.
Bestowed upon him by my lovely daughter.
Wonderful.
And so he could feel like the prettiest princess in all the land.
Right. And we should clarify for those who aren't aware that Chicken Bowl is a chicken-eating contest in addition to a Super Bowl party.
It is a sort of chicken-eating contest with an asterisk next to it, and then that asterisk says also a Super Bowl party.
Do you remember how many pieces of chicken Brian ate?
You know, NPR... Okay, Chicken Bowl started. We're not going to do a whole big long thing on Chicken Bowl, but Chicken Bowl...
Sounds like we are.
It does. I kind of went as if to go on at length.
It's the dawn of time.
Gather
Man
around.
Man has wanted to eat fried things.
Chicken Bowl started in the Midwest, mm-hmm. where there are many eaters. Mm-hmm. It has moved out to the East Coast, which is a
so
bunch of...
So you're saying is Brian ate like three pieces of chicken?
No, he had like nine, but the East Coast, it's a bunch of arugula-chomping soccer watchers at NPR, you know? It's a kind of...
Nothing against arugula or soccer or NPR.
It's a crumpet-munching crop of lightweights. And I cut back my chicken order significantly this year, knowing this, and still had dozens and dozens of extra pieces of chicken. It's just not... Speaking as the record holder for most pieces of chicken eaten all time, with 18, I was... I was disappointed in my craft.
At any rate. So I assume that as is often the case, many people at Chicken Bowl and other Super Bowl parties around the country were distracted by the commercials and the halftime show as much as by the actual football game.
I was going to say there was a rumor that there was some sort of sporting event surrounding that Beyoncé concert.
Yes, exactly. Well, Beyoncé put on the halftime show. And to start with that, Trey, what did you think of the halftime show?
I thought it was pretty dazzling. And I've got to say that I am not a big Beyoncé consumer. So sitting down and watching her really kind of bring it the way she brought it was really kind of eye-opening for me. I know she's good. You know, I've heard her, obviously, but I haven't watched her a whole lot.
She had a big all-girl band.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
And the members of Destiny's Child were launched onto the stage and landed in heels.
Yeah.
That was
right?
The most impressive thing.
Very
like
impressive.
The first thing I thought of was liability. First thing I thought of was like, well, that's just not safe. So that's how I can tell I'm over 40.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of the halftime show?
I thought it was great. I thought it was great. Again, I'm not a big consumer of Beyoncé, as it were, but I recognized
Apparently
all the songs.
We're talking about consuming Beyoncé. Really
well, Beyoncé as product. You know, I am a big football fan, but was busy with hosting duties throughout the event. But when the Beyoncé concert started, I thought my house was actually going to tilt to one side from the flood of everyone in attendance amassing around the TV to consume it. And I have to say, I've watched a lot of Super Bowls, and I've watched a lot of Super Bowl halftime shows, and I think this may be the best one.
Yeah, well, it's definitely...
For sheer quality.
For a while, they were really going in the direction of nostalgia acts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not putting down the current abilities of The Who or
right.
Bruce Springsteen or
Tom
anybody
Petty
like
or...
that. But, you know, they've really been emphasizing people who they're probably the peak of their popularity is not right this minute.
They also emphasize not doing anything controversial.
Well, that's the other thing. I think this is the first Super Bowl halftime show that has not been planned to not be like Janet Jackson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This seems to be the first truly post-Janet Jackson's breast halftime show.
Well, and they also, they have very wisely gotten away from, people always forget, the Super Bowl halftime show of probably about 12 years ago, where it was Edward James Olmos, the cast of The Lion King, and Phil Collins.
Wow. Yeah. Well, they used to be very different, and there is a post in the archives of the blog somewhere where we put some videos up of some old halftime shows, because the old halftime shows really did used to be different, and they were stuff like Up With People.
Yeah, and, so the Up With People era.
And kind of group dance numbers and stuff like that.
Yeah, hooray for everything.
Hooray for everything. Has that, and it was really, I believe Michael Jackson was one of the first ones that was like a current pop act. And I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly what year it was. But, you know, after that, they moved much more into having pop acts all the way up through having Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson. And then they really pulled back in the direction of, you know, let's have Tom Petty. Let's have Bruce Springsteen.
Probably the raciest post-Janet Jackson one would be Prince.
Prince, definitely, you know, there were a few issues.
Guitar shooting sparks and whatnot.
Yeah.
There were a few issues with the neck of the guitar. It is very true. But, you know, but it did seem to me to be a good halftime show.
Sure.
Yeah, there was some significant technology on display. I'm still trying to figure out how they did some of that.
Yeah, well, and apparently the halftime show, according to some sources, they were trying to blame the halftime show for the fact that shortly after the halftime show, there was a 34-minute power outage in the Superdome.
Which is showmanship.
Well, yeah.
All the wattage was used up.
Yeah.
Well, at one point she asked everybody to reach out and show her their hands so she could feel their energy. So maybe that's maybe some kind of conduit thing.
Right.
Breaker.
Well, it was interesting because when I was watching it at home by this time because this was post. I was a chicken bowl for a while and then I was at home. And I was watching it at home and sitting in front of the TV and all of a sudden I thought, the lights just went out, right? But they had lost the announcing booth in addition to the lights.
And you were so excited and relieved.
So everybody's kind of sitting. There's kind of no talking on the TV about what is going on. And I'm looking thinking, this is not supposed to be off, right? The lights are out. Uh-huh. And so, of course, now you have the power of Twitter to go and look on your... You go look at Twitter and you have a bunch of other people saying, the lights seem to have gone out. And immediately... there is a flood of Bane jokes because, of course, Bane took out the football stadium
in Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises. And all of a sudden, the entire rest of this 34-minute blackout is really just people trying to get to the joke before everybody else. Uh-huh. There's the Bane jokes. There's the tentative, nervous Hurricane Katrina jokes because it's the Superdome.
Right.
My personal favorite of those, and I mentioned this on the blog, was Dave Weigel, who tweeted, fortunately, the bar for worst power outage in the Superdome is set really high.
Yep.
Were there any, like, fake Twitter accounts for the power outage?
There was Superdome Lights, I think it was called.
Goodness.
And the first tweet was, I effed up, or something like that. And then there were... I went and looked later, and there were 24,000 people following it.
Yep.
I thought, you don't need to follow that account, y'all. Yeah. It's only going to be here for a short time.
Exactly. The advertisers jumped on it. Oreos did, you can still dunk in the dark, see? Finger on the pulse, not funny, but fast.
How quick was it?
Pretty quick.
Yeah.
And Tide kind of missed the mark, because what Tide said is, we can't get your blackout, but we can get your stains out.
Boy. It's a little uncomfortable, right? I don't know how I feel about that.
Nice really, try.
You know, the funny thing about the blackout, and this is essentially what I wrote on the blog this morning, is that the blackout was by far the most interesting part of the entire show because it was unexpected.
Right.
And if there's one thing you can say for the Super Bowl, it is that everything in it is meticulously choreographed.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And even the game, you always feel like, well, it's just a football game. Plus a bunch of stuff that is so meticulously choreographed and you have all these announcers and they're all useless.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they finally got the announcers back, and there's a great Will Leach piece about this that was out this morning that we'll link to, but they all just were completely, they had no idea what to do. And I have said before that an NFL pregame show or halftime show or whatever is just a male version of The View.
Mm-hmm.
And you would not want the women of The View to vamp for 34 minutes. And that's essentially what this was.
No.
It was dude View vamping for 34 minutes.
Well, yeah. And you also have the whole, like, football punditry, which is as useless as
much political
punditry. It's sort of the equivalent of, like, when you watch a political debate, and then for the half hour after the political debate, you have the hacks on either side just spouting talking points. I mean, politics and sports have a lot in common in terms of just filling the air with predictions that don't have to come true.
And analysis that doesn't always bear any relation to reality.
Well, the thing that was amazing, too, was that it was right after halftime. So they had kind of just dumped anything pithy they thought of in the first half.
It really was the worst
possible time.
They came
back. There were like two or three plays. I mean, one of them was a big play because it was a kickoff return. But there had been only a couple plays, and now they're expected to fill 34 minutes. They just got done literally emptying their brain pans of anything that was in there. And now
Not literally. It wouldn't have taken as long.
You're right. It's not literally. But truly, genuinely saying everything they had, and then some.
I mean,
then it's like, just talk for half an hour about nothing else having happened.
Well, anyone who has ever had to vamp in that situation will tell you that it's a legitimately terrifying thing. I do wish that they had, given how meticulously choreographed for every eventuality the Super Bowl is, it would have been nice had they had some actual blockbuster thing they could have done.
Right.
Like, have Beyonce trot back out and sing a cappella.
Right.
Well, there is a... It immediately brought to mind for me, there is a Sports Night episode in which they have an hour and a half blocked out to cover this fight, this boxing match, which lasts 7 seconds. And then everyone is like, and then they're all running around and they're like, I don't know, because nobody has an hour and a half worth of material.
The experienced hosts in the better quarters of this building refer to that as knowing how to hold the air.
I will tell you, Bob Boylan did a live webcast of a Lucinda Williams concert, and you have to, when you do those, you have to kind of guess that the band is about to start when you start kind of doing your quick, and we're here from blah, 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 blah. You know, for all songs considered, I'm Bob Boylan. And he starts it, because the band comes out, and they start kind of like warming up, and the crowd goes, woo! 52 minutes later. So Bob vamped for 52, somewhere in the NPR archives, not online, not for public consumption, is 52 minutes of Bob Boylan.
At some point, you just start asking people in the crowd to identify themselves, right?
And where
are you
from? Exactly. And unfortunately, those are done in like a crow's nest, because you could think he could wander through the crowd and interview people.
So how excited are you about this upcoming Lucinda Williams concert?
Somewhere between 20 seconds and an hour from now, you have no idea.
Yeah. It was, to me, the blackout was the only thing that brought life to that broadcast, because I do always find the Super Bowl oddly lifeless, even though
a very good game.
Even though they came back and it got very tight and it was very exciting and all this, if I get all that, I still always find it much more lifeless, less lifeful than a regular Sunday football
game. It's football, except it takes longer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because of the commercials.
Yes.
What do you guys think?
Look at you, segue man.
I'm trying.
There was something about
to get out of talking about football.
There was something about Psy and pistachio nuts. That was the only commercial in real time that I saw.
Thank you for telling us it's time for you to go away, Psy. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Here's the door.
The great part of that was that it gave me an opportunity, because he was singing Gangnam Style on TV, it gave me an opportunity to ask Twitter whether I was the only person who thinks it sounds like Condom Style. Uh-huh. And everyone supported me, and I felt great. I've always been too embarrassed to ask that question.
Right. You were basically carried off the field by Twitter.
I was. I've never, as I said, I have never had such a swell of public support since my apartment flooded.
Did you guys all see the Budweiser Black Crown ads?
I saw some of that.
Okay.
I don't think I saw the Black Crown.
I
saw the Clydesdale.
Okay.
I did see someone refer to it as beer for... bad word, beer for jerks, but they didn't say jerks.
No. We can say it. Repellent D-bags.
Yeah.
It was aimed at... You'll be among the cool kids if you drink this product. It was about as nakedly done as possible. It just, the problem is that the cool kids are awful people. Awful people wearing fedoras. Yeah. Their black clothes looking all...
It should be noted that Glenn is making finger
guns.
Doing finger guns.
Which he rarely does.
And leave it to Coca-Cola to discover the warm, fuzzy part of the global surveillance state that we all find ourselves in. It's like, what are you, crazy?
It was surveillance footage of, like, people hugging.
Oh, my God. It's like Big Brother sometimes gives you a hug. It's like, no.
It was a bad thing.
It
was like, look, the upside of cameras everywhere.
Oh my God.
Is that we got this guy leaning over and kissing his girlfriend. Isn't that sweet?
We thought we were alone,
but they were wrong.
Yeah. It is crazy.
Well, yeah. That was definitely a strange one. I think the one that got the most attention was a Dodge truck ad.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this.
Which basically involves just a long excerpt of a Paul Harvey speech.
And on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker. So God made a farmer.
And it talks about, you know, because he needed someone who would get up early and be committed to family and make food and be awesome and fix birds.
Oh, yeah. Hop off a tractor to splint the leg of a meadowlark. Now, come on.
Yeah.
Is that what you call
is
like a farmer thing now.
Overdetermined prose.
But people found it incredibly moving. Sure. And I think the thing that was weird to me about it did not have any idea it was a truck ad. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I actually assumed it was some sort of like farm ad. Like was somebody I apologize for not remembering who it was, but it is some pro athlete who was quoted having tweeted, that does it. Tomorrow morning, I'm buying a farmer. Yeah. It's kind of a great line because it's like, you would think it's an ad for farmers.
Right, that's what we're selling.
It's an ad for trucks.
It was based on an online ad that the farms.com or whatever. Right. I don't know. Yeah. Farms.com. Mm-hmm. It's like some farming trade association.
I think it actually is farms.com.
Okay. Some farming trade association did that they just kind of threw a lot of money at to make it look a lot better. I came away from it thinking, well, Paul Harvey was really good. I mean, you might not agree
absolutely.
With the man.
Right.
But he was really good at what he did. Mm-hmm. It's a conceptual ad. I mean, this is the kind of thing that Don Draper would be all over. It's, mm-hmm. it's about you're allying your brand to iconography, not to
a
product.
And there are a couple like this every year,
it seems
to me.
Well, this is, and you were talking about this on Twitter, Linda, and I saw you talking about it, that you were saying, I don't know what this is an ad for. And I was reminded, and I kind of wanted to talk about this, about advertising when a really stylish, memorable ad is made for a product that is not retained by the audience. And isn't that a gigantic failure of advertising?
They obviously don't think so. And people were sort of saying to me last night, well, you don't know it's for trucks because you don't understand that this would obviously be a truck commercial. And I was like, well, that's okay, fine. But then this morning I was in a meeting where a bunch of people said, you know, for Toyota or whatever truck it was.
Well,
I was like, that seems like a problem to me.
See,
like
10 years ago, I interviewed Stan Freberg, the great radio man, mm-hmm. voice actor, you know. And among other things, Stan Freberg was a great, great, great ad man. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying, as he launched into this broadside, which I have a feeling he launches into a few broadsides, mm-hmm. that guy. And he went into this whole thing about how, advertising has gotten so creative, but what are the ads for? Mm-hmm. He said, if you listen to any of my ads, you always come away knowing what the product is.
Well, the challenge inherent, presumably, or at least one of them, but it would seem to me that the central challenge inherent in this thing is that if you're trying to associate your brand with an icon or some sort of trope about Americans and what makes us feel good, then you have to be not tacky when you bring the brand in.
You have to be unintrusive.
Yeah. You bring up an avatar at the end of your ad.
Right. And the question becomes, did you create a strong enough connection between the iconography and the your brand? There was a similar ad, essentially an ad for military families.
Yeah, it was for the USO,
Jeep,
right?
That was a Jeep ad.
Yeah.
And I think narrated by Oprah.
By Oprah Winfrey,
And it's in a very sort of intense Oprah voice. And I had the same question about that one. I mean, that one had a little more Jeep stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I heard some people talking about the fact that they're also calling upon a connection between the military and Jeep.
Well, and Jeep probably did that ad in partnership.
Yeah,
with another entity.
It was the USO.
Yeah.
And they were very smart about it. They had a little call out at the very end to the effect of what they're donating to the USO.
Sure.
To me, they're donating
the cost of this ad.
There have always been these ads. There was the Clint Eastwood. There was these sort of really sincere, let's make a little mini movie that makes everyone feel great, and then at the end, boom, it's my product.
Sure, but
that's not new.
They're spending $3.8 million for every 30 seconds just for the rights to broadcast the commercial. So the Samsung ad with Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen was 2 minutes long.
Two minutes. minutes.
$15.2 million to fill the screen with two actors I feel very genially towards.
Right.
I enjoyed that commercial.
And that commercial was targeted to me as much as the GoDaddy ads are targeted to 14-year-old sexist pigs. Mm-hmm. But still, it felt loose. I just kept seeing the dollar signs just turning over as these guys were just, it's Bob Odenkirk. Hey,
I love Bob Odenkirk. Yeah.
But I mean, am I going to buy a Samsung phone? I don't think so. Yeah. You know, the one that was ruthlessly efficient, I thought, was the one about Hyundai has some kind of car with a turbo boost. You demonstrate what you're advertising.
Right.
So, okay, so this car is a turbo, which means you can accelerate very quickly when you need to. So when you're behind a bunch of different funny things, you can accelerate. It was like, ah, I get it.
Yeah.
It's right there.
I mean, I think we're, you know, people would tell us that we're all very unsophisticated because we all expect advertising to be straightforward and to work in a straightforward way, and it often doesn't, and I get all that, and that's fine. And you know, there comes a point where, you know, you're a brand like Doritos, and Doritos every year for the Super Bowl does a bunch of ads where there's a dude who's a dummy and there's animals. That is their thing. They do it every year. There are other brands who do an endless stream of ads where some dork interacts with a model, and they do it every year, and it's always the same basic structure. So to me, I feel like the Super Bowl ad game has sort of run its course in their current form, because they feel like they're all, it feels to me like they're all making the same ad over and over again. They're making the old people are funny ad.
Sure.
They're making the dorks and models ads. They're making the crazy
Americana
animal ad, and they're making the Americana ads. So I'm kind of wondering whether, you know, they're going to have to come up with something else.
Yeah, when do we get a new category?
Like
One part of this is for a lot of people, and obviously these are very privileged people who can say this, but for a lot of people, this is one of the few times of the year they even see advertising anymore.
Like I said, they seem to be making the same ads, and I'm just wondering whether they're running out of steam.
Yeah.
I don't know. But here we are again talking about them, so maybe not.
One last thing. Beck's Sapphire new beer.
Oh, terrible.
Has a giant red gem on the label because apparently words don't mean anything anymore.
Yeah. Oh, I will say one. I do have one nice thing to say about the Clydesdales ad where the guy raises the little horse and then it goes off to be a Clydesdale and then he goes and sees it in the big city. It's so sweet. It was I had to admit I liked that one.
Oh,
when the horse
breaks loose and goes chasing around the corner, I got a big old lump in my throat.
Yeah, exactly. The horse is like, Dad, right? Dad, and the horse is coming to say
you
hi.
You sold me to a beer company.
Dad, I miss you so much. And the horse is coming and the guy is waiting for the horse, and then the guy has to stop the horse like, whoa, buddy.
Don't go too fast.
It's all right, buddy. And then they hug. And
somewhere they don't hug.
They do.
They do hug.
He hugs the horse. They don't hug.
I just want to point out that
this is like, I'm like Rita Wilson in Sleepless in Seattle explaining how An Affair to Remember goes. They know and they hug.
I got to say, the Clydesdales is the best thing Anheuser-Busch ever did.
Well, we hope to hear from you about what you enjoyed at the Super Bowl, whether the halftime show or the ads or the blackout, that being my favorite. The MVP was the blackout. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Okay. So it's almost Valentine's Day.
It is.
Stephen.
Oh, God.
Explain to me how you feel about Valentine's Day.
You know, I like to maintain a sort of sticky veneer of positivity.
Yeah. You know, come to think of it, I think we've actually made you do this before, so I'm not going to make you do it again. I think what we have had you explain before is it is terrible for everyone, whether you are single, you are in a new relationship, you are in an old relationship. Right.
And that
it is horrible for everyone.
And that it all boils down to some layer of kind of artificial obligation.
Right.
And that is my official stance on Valentine's Day. And I have tried to soften
Ready,
it.
Ladies? Line up.
I've tried to sort of soften it over time, but I mean, it basically is a holiday like many other holidays in which you are sort of expected to make a person feel prioritized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in general, the spirit of that, the spirit of an occasion to let people know that you prioritize them, I think makes sense. Now, the holiday itself is one of those things where I think most people, certainly most people I know, view it as a nuisance and a burden.
And you had a nice piece about this in your music advice column, which we will link to that too. And people who want to hear more about Stephen Thompson's views
dying.
On Valentine's
Day. Yeah, exactly.
But this did get us talking about what is romantic in pop culture, particularly since pop culture is so obsessed with trying very hard, I would say, to be romantic. Mm-hmm. Glenn, you look excited. You look like you're dying to chime in.
This is not my topic. You know, I was trying to think of examples of, you know, romantic love that actually isn't sappy and isn't sentimental and actually works. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Leopold and Loeb? I mean, I got nothing.
Oh, God.
I got absolutely nothing.
Oh, my God.
But I do have some examples from comics, which I think actually work really well.
Nice.
My issue here, before I talk about these three from the comics, my issue here is that I think falling in love is a lot of fun to do, but it's just like you mentioned the other week, Stephen. It's like eating bacon. It's a lot of fun to do. It's not a lot of fun for me to watch.
Yep.
Because it's a selfish act. It's about, you're saying, does this person meet my needs?
Mm-hmm.
And falling in love, when you see somebody doing it, I have to really be invested in whether or not that person falls in love. Because otherwise, if somebody's quirky or a klutz, or like, that doesn't endear you to me.
Yeah,
falling in love is selfish, but staying in love is about matching your needs to that of another person.
Sure.
That is an ongoing negotiation. It's much more difficult. It's much harder work. It is also doesn't make for really good fiction.
No.
It's hard to tell stories about. Mm-hmm. So that's why when I was thinking of examples of romantic couples that I'm interested in, I was thinking of Marge and Homer Simpson.
Okay.
There is a love. There is real affection there.
Which is constantly tested.
Yes, which is constantly tested and has to be renegotiated. And most of that testing happens in one direction, not the other.
Yeah.
But when I was first seeing that show back when it first started, I felt James L. Brooks's presence there inflecting this heart into everything. And I really rebelled against it at first. Now I really think that that's a key part of the show, and it's what distinguishes it from a show like Family Guy, where there's actual real emotion at the core of it. The other one I had is also named Marge. It's Marge and Norm Gunderson from Fargo.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Great one.
You don't spend a lot of time in that movie seeing their relationship because you don't need to, because it conveyed so perfectly, so effortlessly in fleeting scenes.
Prowler needs a jump.
Prowler needs a jump. He gets out of a bed on a cold morning to go make her some eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta get him eggs, Margie.
Before she goes to work.
Before she goes to work. That's what it's about.
Right.
That's what love is.
Well, and then
making
there's also
eggs.
All the stuff with the duck stamp. He's working on his entry for the
and
duck
she
stamp,
supports
which
him.
If you were in Minnesota, you know the duck stamp's a big thing.
Right.
Because a lot of people get the duck stamp and a lot of people see the duck stamp. So that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And she's supportive of this thing that he's doing. That's a great pick. I
that's
love
real
that pick.
So
I'll
get to my comics one in a bit, but I want to hear from some other folks first.
All right.
Well, the one that came to mind for me, and I was focusing a little bit more specifically on romantic gestures in the context of Valentine's
Day.
Sure,
of course.
Sure.
And, you know, stories about Valentine's Day in particular. And the one that I'm fond of recently is there was an original episode and then there was a callback a year later, I think, on Modern Family, where they have the role-playing thing and they go to the hotel to sort of rekindle their romance.
Phil and Claire.
And it, you know, it goes horribly awry, as it must. But again, as Glenn says, I think those two actors are so easy with each other that you do feel a certain honesty to the sense of affection.
I agree.
Right?
I agree. And I think what they do well on that show with that couple is that they manage to make them both sort of flawed enough that it doesn't all run in one direction. When they first started that show, it seemed like it could get a little bit dumb husband, eye-rolling wife.
Yes.
But really what it's developed into is they both have these really strange qualities and these really not always likable qualities. And in fact, the one where she gets, I think it's Spandau Ballet, she actually brings, it's Edward Norton playing
as
the part of the guy
from
Spandau Ballet, comes to the house to sing what she is saying is their song.
Yes.
And he sings, and Phil tells us, that's not our song. Our song was something else entirely, and I'm not going to remember what it was. But there is a way in which he accepts this gift from her and does not feel the need to correct her. And even though she has theoretically screwed up what she intends as this incredibly great romantic gesture, in a way that your typical romantic figure, you know, the way that plot would normally go is the other person would get all upset and it would become a huge fight and she would have to track down the right person and the right song to make it right because you've screwed up the romantic gesture. What they did on that show was, and it was a great moment for Phil, who kind of was able to say, she screwed it up, but that's okay. She loves me, and he hugged her.
He takes it as meant.
Absolutely. So. I agree. Good choice. I wouldn't have picked Phil and Claire, but that's a good choice.
I like them.
How about you, Thompson?
Well, Glenn made a great point about the part of love that does not get depicted enough is the act of staying in love.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite songs of all time, and I'm sure, Linda, you have heard me talk about this song before, is a Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash song called As Long as the Grass Shall Grow. Mm-hmm. And it started out actually as a protest song, but was sort of recast as a love song with a new lyric. And it was released on a Johnny Cash box set called Unearthed in 2003, and right around the time that they both died. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is also around the time of, like, Walk the Line. And so people, the story of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash is very, very fresh in people's heads. You know, how difficult it was for them to sort of find each other and have their relationship be sort of validated.
Yep.
And this song, kind of sung near the end of their lives, is just absolutely breathtaking.
It's wonderful. Let's hear a little bit of it.
I met you in the shadows, and your face was all aglow. I remember it so well, though it was many years ago. We both knew something happened without a lot to say. But we had other lives, and so we went our separate ways. But our hearts communicated, and every time we passed, we were gradually building something that would forever last. As long as the moon shall rise, as long as the rivers flow, as long.
I love that song.
Yep. Oh, that is some wonderfully simple songwriting.
Yeah.
And the song just wrecks me. And there's a point in it late, which I hope I can talk about without actually crying, where he just sort of says, you know, I love you. I love you. And it's just...
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. And that's woven into the lyric.
Yeah.
It is... Wow, it is a perfect song. And it is one of... It's maybe the most romantic song, in my opinion, ever written.
Hmm. Yep. Sentiment without sentimentality. It reaches for something and it gets it.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
I gotta say, that's a voice that really took me time to grow into.
Johnny.
Yeah. Really? When I was young, I didn't get it because I, you know, I was kind of rebelling against all things country grew up.
And I've got this whole theory about when you find voices and how certain voices you have to grow, mm-hmm. you have to grow into an appreciation of them. I did this with Tom Waits, where for a long time I just did not connect with it. And eventually I think you live life long enough voice starts to actually connect with you.
You wake up in a couple whorehouses covered in whiskey. It just takes you the 3 or 4 times, and then
it's been enough time pawing through the gutter, and Tom Waits starts to mean something.
Yeah, it's interesting that you would talk about sort of phases of your life, because what this really brought up for me is that what I have found romantic at different times in my life has been completely different. And normally, I'm not a sort of like every mixtape is autobiographical. Like, I'm not that kind of person. I don't normally believe that everything you like is speaking directly through your own life. But I do think that because what is romantic or not romantic, aside from like a value judgment, I mean, obviously, when you talk about something being incredibly romantic, you're partly talking about it being effective. And in a way, you're saying it's good art. But in another way, what appeals to you at a particular time, I think as you get older, you do prioritize that staying together, the longevity of, you're like, this is why it's like, oh my God, the most romantic movie of the year is Amour. Like, it's like, because you begin to care a lot more about that idea of permanence, and you begin to think a lot more about companionship. And it's not that you lose your interest in things that are romantic or sexy in traditional ways or whatever, but what you find romantic is different. What you find romantic, and even what you find sexy, but what you find romantic changes according to where your mind is. So I think that's why when you're in your teens or 20s, you can often find more flashy romance in kind of like the fight, kiss, for example, thing, which sort of gives you all this fuel for, you know, the fun of banter, because you've kind of just gotten good at banter.
Right.
Maybe not everyone, but, you know, if you've just gotten good at it, the idea that it's going to, like, ignite into someone's in love with you is very exciting. But then by the time you're, let's say, 35... you sort of sit there like, yeah, that's, first of all, like, you get really tired.
Right.
Second of all,
yeah,
those people eventually break up because a lot of times you're fighting. Mm-hmm. And so ordinary frontwards compatibility as opposed to, like, backwards compatibility,
oh,
like
great.
Opposites attract and all
yeah.
that stuff.
Yeah.
It's not that there aren't people who have opposite qualities that attract. It's not that people are attracted or become happy only with people who are just like them. But the idea that you're looking for someone who doesn't appeal to you at all when you meet them, that is something that as you get older, it's like, yeah, no, I don't think so. No, I actually think what's good is when you meet someone, you're like, wow, I really like this person.
Yeah.
That begins to be what feels really romantic to you.
Oh, yeah. My God. I've said a million times that the most underrated emotion in all of human interaction
right.
is liking someone.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there are things in my life that I can very specifically trace to, like, this was romantic to me because it was what I wanted. Like, one sort of obscure example was when I watched Murphy Brown and when she fell in love with Scott Bakula. That was very clearly
that was around
written.
The time we all fell in love with Scott Bakula.
That was very clearly written to be a story where the whole thing of that coupling was she was loud and outspoken and didn't get along with everyone and had a big noisy personality, and he really liked her and he really liked that about her, and to me that was like, well, that is rad. To me that was like, well, I certainly hope that can happen, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So it's so subjective based on where you are in your life, and some things you find romantic, you know, on and on for years. But I think in a lot of ways it does kind of change according to where you are and what you're prioritizing at that moment.
Mm-hmm. I'll buy that.
There are three comics I want to mention here that really do the romantic love thing really, really well. One is
Archie.
Well, that's if you're a masochist, I guess you could say. Terry Moore's Strangers in Paradise is a series that went on for 14 years, 90 issues. It ended in 2007. You're not going to find a more involving, more layered, more smart, more adult, really, examination of relationships. Kachu is the main character's nickname, is in love with her best friend, Francine. Francine can't deal with her feelings for Kachu. In the middle of it all, there's this David who is also in love with Kachu. It's these three characters who go through a lot and their lives keep intertwining. It is just beautiful, real. It's also weird. There's also a whole espionage, you know, subplot going on in there, but it's just fantastic. So you can check it out. It's in several omnibuses. Omnibuy. Terry Moore's Strangers in Paradise. There's also Blankets by Craig Thompson.
Yeah.
Craig Thompson wrote Habibi, which is one of the things that was making me happy last year. I reviewed it for NPR. If you want to read that review, you can check it out online. Blankets is a book that people like me hand to people like you, non-comics guys, and say, this is what comics can do.
It's a gateway drug. That
it book. Really, really is. And it's a story about this couple who have to deal with their religious faith and wanting to be together. It's just smart and really great. And then in the 90s, Grant Morrison did a run on a book called Doom Patrol, which is my favorite single string of comics in history, in which he took two supervillains who had been around a long time in the DC universe, kind of in the background. Monsieur Malat, who is a gorilla with a machine gun and a beret.
Sold.
Because he's French and the French have berets. And the Brain. The Brain is exactly what it sounds like. He's a brain encased in a giant stylized jar and revealed that they were gay lovers. And it was just so weird and good and real. That's the thing about it. It was also real. It wasn't just played for laughs. So those are the three that I really dig.
It's awesome.
Nice.
Well, I hope that that you will all come and find us and give us lots of examples of what you think is romantic, and that you will enjoy your Valentine's Day with whoever you're enjoying it with, if appropriate, and that you will blow it off, if appropriate.
It's also my son's birthday,
Valentine's
Day. So it has been redeemed in my eyes.
So that's the real reason it's good.
That's right.
Well, that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, amid all the kerfuffle of Super Bowl / Chicken Bowl / everything else, a new album was released overnight by a group called My Bloody Valentine. First album by this band in 21-plus years. And the last My Bloody Valentine record came out in 1991, was called Loveless, and is a classic of kind of bleary, smeary, guitar-y, drone-y, tremolo-y, totally inscrutable, very pretty, for me, the sound of college freshman year. Well, suddenly I got to be transported back to college freshman year, which isn't always a good thing, but they released an album on the internet called MBV, and here, let's hear a few seconds of it. This song is called Who Sees You. Just to give you a feel of the kind of that is listening to My Bloody Valentine. It's very enveloping. Because you can't understand a damn word of it, it's great for editing. You know, this album is incredibly long-awaited. Like I said, 21 years. This sort of Salinger-esque. There has been a long wait for this record. And basically the way they released it was a few days before it came out, they said, oh, I think we're going to release an album in the next few days. And, you know, now I'm guilty of this. I'm a part of this. I'm a part of the machine. Instead of these slow release rollouts where it's like, on 9 websites, you'll get to see 1/9 of the cover art of the album coming out in 3 months. You know, just this agonizing promotional rollout. I love the mixture of like mystery and matter of factness. And, you know, David Bowie sort of doing the same thing, like, hey, I secretly recorded an album.
Right.
I love that side of the way that albums can be released now. And I loved the sort of, yep, plunk, here it is. And it's lovely. I mean, it's very much of a piece with everything else the band has done.
But yeah.
Welcome back. Delighted to have them back.
Excellent. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Well, today, Monday, February 4th, as we tape this, it is today the 75th anniversary of the Broadway opening of Our Town by Thornton Wilder. And this evening at Ford's Theater, the occasional Monkey See contributor and friend of the podcast, Mark Blankenship, has a short documentary film premiering. It's called In Our Living and Our Dying, which is a line from the play. And he talks to a range of theater professionals, including Eric Stoltz and director Gregory Mosher, about what keeps this play relevant in the 21st century. There's also a conversation with a French playwright and academic who translated the play into French, which, you know, you've got to wonder how that works.
Right.
Anyway, it's about 7 minutes, and it's a smart film, and by the time you hear this, it will be available online, which
nice.
Is why I'm telling you about it. So we will put up a link to that. Also making me happy, all 13 episodes of House of Cards, which I binge-watched over the weekend. It's gorgeously shot. Kevin Spacey is not too hammy, and they've really fleshed out the story and the characters very nicely. This is, and the original of this was one of my favorite things ever. So now there are 13 hours of it. I've watched all 13, and I'm going to watch them again. It's earned a lot of critical praise, and it absolutely deserves it.
And it's awesome. On Netflix.
It is on Netflix exclusively, yes.
For Netflix.
Yeah. In its entirety.
In its entirety, and it all dropped at once.
And they actually film it in D.C., or at least the locations are actually in D.C.
Yeah, they filmed. They had actually relatively few shooting days in D.C., but they got a lot of sort of cover footage.
Yeah.
And they actually filmed most of it in Baltimore.
Yeah, well, still, take that homeland.
Shame on
that. Stupid Farragut Square.
All right, all right. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I had folks over on Sunday to watch the screener of Les Miserables. here's a film that's not for the Glens of the world, and I knew that going in. And I invited friends over who are not big pop culture people. They have a new kid, and they're tired, and they're not watching films. And we're 15 minutes into it, and my friend Martha says, wait, Hugh Jackman's in this? So that's kind of where they are. That's their level. And, you know, I'll be very honest, we did not give this film a fair shot because we were talking over it, making fun of it now and then. And, you know, at one point I was in the kitchen just before the first disc of the 2-disc screener ended. I was in the kitchen making coffee and talking to my friend Martha about her kid, and I could still see the television, hear the music, and I noticed that the hairs on the back of my neck were standing up, and I was like, well, that's weird, because I'm follically challenged, but there are hairs on the back of my neck, and they were standing up, and I didn't think anything of it at the time. So the disc ends, and we're all sitting around, and they're trying to debate whether or not they should go back home to relieve the babysitter, and we're all kind of saying, yeah, it's really not, you know, grabbing us. Then Martha, there's a pause, and Martha says, that last song was pretty good, though. And my friend Art said, yeah, that was really good. What was it, One Day More, One More Day? What is that song? And there's another pause. And then I said, we should see that again. And
we went back because what happens, I believe this is physiological. At first I thought it was like, okay, this is some gay dog whistle thing. You know, we just respond to it because we must. But these were two egregiously heterosexual people who had this reaction to this song, One Day More, mm-hmm. where all the different threads, the melodies that you've been listening to mm-hmm. for an hour and a half or whatever, yep. come together. And it is physiological. It is pure.
Oh, yeah. It's a technique. It's a very consciously deployed technique
oh, absolutely.
On the part of the songwriters. They've given you all these melodies. They've beaten them into your heads. And now they're going to put them in counterpoint with
now
each other.
Now they're
going to
cash them in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It reached through layers of irony and snark and disinterest yeah. and grabbed me. And we watched it again after that.
The song or the whole movie?
No, just
all
that, that,
like, I gotta
just
see the
that song. Because there are reasons that this thing didn't work on me. Which we'll talk about when we have our Oscar show. But, I mean, a legitimate surprise. That's what was making me happy.
Nice. I will mention a couple of little things, one of which is the YouTube video, the pep talk from the kid president, brought to my attention by Gene Demby, who is on NPR's new race and culture team that they're in the process of rolling out a lot more stuff from those folks.
Who Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners don't know they love yet.
Exactly. If you read, Gene did the piece on the blog about Django and Lincoln. He's done a couple different things, and he showed me this nifty YouTube video from Kid President, who gives this pep talk where he explains how you have no right not to be awesome. And I actually have had cause to go back and listen to the Kid President's pep talk a couple times. And I really appreciated it. I also wanted to mention, since we did have a conversation a couple weeks ago about the Big Bang Theory and about their treatment of Sheldon and whether has Asperger's or whatever, they did a very interesting episode this week where he eventually gave a very simple explanation in which he actually said to some of his friends, "My entire life, I have had trouble with physical contact that other people find pleasant. Hugging, handshaking." And there's a joke at the end. He says prostate exams. But it is a straightforward, you know, he is discussing essentially this woman that he is sort of dating, but that it is a completely non-physical thing. And he is explaining why that is so hard for him. And eventually he is saying, "But maybe someday." And it's actually quite touching. It's actually this very unexpected, straightforward handling of his kind of issues with, you know, "I don't like to be touched. I don't like..." And it felt really sort of, to me, emphatic. And I really liked it. And if you're interested in kind of how that worked, you might go back and find that episode from this week. But the primary thing I wanted to mention this week, since we were on the topic of what is romantic, I do listen to a fair number of kind of love stories on audiobook. And I've been listening to a delightful audiobook called Stay, which is by a writer named Allie Larkin. Unfortunately, it is her first book, which ticked me off because when I figured out there weren't any other ones, I was like, well, geez. So now I'm harassing her on Twitter, and she says that there is another one soon. So that's what I like to do with authors. I've done it with a couple people, Rainbow Rowell and some other people. I just bothered them on Twitter about when their next book is.
You're also asking for another Budweiser commercial.
Exactly. Oh. But this book is essentially about, it is from a subcategory of romance that I call Pets and Vets. Essentially what happens is the woman has a big lovable dog and she meets a cute vet. And that it is not the first story along those lines that I've read, but it's a nice subgenre and it's a really nice story. And I've been listening to the audiobook, which is read by an actress named Julia Whalen. And Julia Whalen is not an incredibly famous actress, but if you watched the very good and underappreciated Cela Ward and Billy Campbell show Once and Again, she played the daughter who wasn't Evan Rachel Wood on that show.
Jess Gittner just gave you big thumbs up, by the way, our producer.
It was a terrific show. It was an underappreciated show. And the kids on that show were excellent. And she was one of them. And when I figured out that was who that was, I thought, oh, I'm really glad she's doing something I like. And I believe she also did the audiobook of Gone Girl.
Oh,
and so, although I didn't listen to that. So I have been listening to it. It's just extremely charming. Again, it's called Stay. It's by Allie Larkin. You can also obviously read it as a regular book, but I have been enjoying the audiobook. And so I've been appreciative of that. It's been a nice calming sort of thing to have. So that's what's
Wonderful.
Making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.